Accession number 27344, Reel 8.
Rope McCandless, Reel 8.
After we'd been doing all these practice torpedo attacks, as I say, the assessors were always giving us results. And this 3 foot length of strip of paper are my results for my time at Crail. And you can see there are probably something like 60 different attacks. And they all give the calculation error, range error, height error, and attitude error. And it was really extremely well done, in so much as you could look at that when you'd finished and know if you improved, when you improved, or why you improved. But that was, I think, one of the better ways in which we were given our results. It really was extremely good.
Did you feel at the end of the course, with all that kind of assessment, that you felt competent in being able to make an attack?
Oh, yes, absolutely, yeah. Anyway, after Crail, we went to East Haven, near Dundee. And I can't remember the HMS name of East Haven, unless it was Peewit or something like that. And at East Haven, we were being taught dive bombing and deck landing. So we just carried on from the same sort of things that we'd been doing at Crail, but learning to drop bombs on targets, which were floating targets in the River Tay. And the assessments of how good you were there were done by range assessors who were in two huts, about, I suppose, 3/4 of a mile apart on the north bank of the Tay, and they had sights on the target, which would be perhaps 3/4 of a mile offshore, something like that. And in addition to that, they had a screen to one side. And we were required always to attack this target in the same direction, which was at 90 degrees to this screen. Now, the screen was a large perspex thing, which had on it lines at 10 degree intervals from 0 up to 90 degrees. And one of the assessors would sit behind this screen looking at the aircraft as they were starting to dive. And each time we made an attack, we would say, attacking now. And the assessor would look up, see the aircraft entering a dive, and then start to make little crosses on the screen, just showing the track of the aircraft as it came down to the target. And they could then give you a fairly accurate idea of the angle of your dive. So then, once the bomb was dropped, there were 25-pound practice bombs. Once the bomb was dropped, it would drop somewhere near the target, we hope. And when the smoke went up, the two huts, one either side, would take a bearing on the smoke. And then they would put these two bearings on the chart and read off where the lines crossed, where the bomb dropped. And they could say that bomb dropped 5 yards... or 500 yards from wherever it was supposed to be. So it was really a fairly good way of assessing and keeping you in the picture as to what you were doing, because they could call up and say that angle of dive was too shallow, which it usually was, until you really got into it. Because there's no doubt that diving an aircraft at 70 degrees means, because of the lift on the wings, it's moving the aircraft like that. So even when the fuselage of the aircraft is vertical, it's still tracking down at about 70 degrees. So when the aircraft is vertical like that, you're actually hanging in the straps. You're no longer sitting in the seat. So you've got to have your straps really tight to allow you to go on. Hello, my love. So this is something that a lot of pilots took some time to get used to. But in order to deliver a bomb reasonably accurately, you had to be coming down at a very steep angle. And one of the main reasons for this is we had no bomb sight. We just had nothing. We had no gun sight because we had no forward guns and we had no bomb sight. So you were looking through our windscreen and trying to decide where best to get the target in the windscreen. And again, it was just practice, you see. If you do it often enough, you begin to get the feel for it. But in order to get it in the same position in the windscreen, you've got to be doing the same angle of dive. So you've got to get used to entering the dive in such a way that you're going to do it correctly. Now, when you drop a bomb, it is always affected by wind. And the thing is that the aircraft itself, when you're dropping the bomb, is being affected by the same wind. So if you're coming down in a dive and the wind is from one side, then you're being blown off the target. So you've got to turn the wing into wind. So you're maintaining a steady dive down, allowing for that amount of wind. But if the wind is from behind you, it's trying to blow you over the target, so the dive's getting steeper and steeper. And if it's a strong wind, it can get you into a very steep dive, which is terribly uncomfortable, and can, of course, throw the bomb over as well. So in that case, you've got to be allowing the target to get higher and higher in the windscreen in order to allow for the wind effect. And if the wind is coming towards you, it's tending to make your dive shallower and shallower. So you've got to get the target lower and lower in the windscreen to allow for the effect of the wind. And this is why we did so many practice dives. We would take off with 8 practice bombs and do 8 practice dives and do that 3 or 4 times a day so that we were really getting the practice. And you had to do it in all weathers because you can't always have good weather for an attack on an enemy target. So again, we were practicing it in poor visibility and in strong winds and just generally trying to get used to how you had to react to get a hit on the target.
How would you release the bomb from the aircraft?
Oh, we had a button on the stick. So you know how you've probably seen a button on the stick for forward-firing guns. It was exactly the same.
And you said if you took, say, 8 practice bombs up, how would the sequence work there? Would it just release them in an order then?
Yes.
Each time you did it?
Yes. The bomb racks, the practice bomb racks, were fitted onto the main bomb racks and they had within them a timer which would release them. You had to select which wing you wanted to drop from, but once you did that, the timer in the practice bomb carrier would drop them in sequence. You could, in fact, drop them all in a quick sequence. You could set it so that they would drop at half-second intervals. But we were there to get the maximum amount of dive practice, so it was always single bomb release. But anyway, we used to do this quite a lot. Now, we used to dive breaks again, because you would get up to probably too high a speed, I think, without the dive breaks. And so when you had released the bomb, you started to pull out. And again, if you were practicing in an attack, you wanted to get away from the danger area as fast as you could. So, sorry. Generally speaking, you would select neutral on the dive brakes as soon as you had released the bomb. So that meant 2.5 turns back on the trim because you had moved the flaps. And again, you see, from lack of experience, as I say, I was a midshipman. I was very early in my flying career. I found that if I turned it back, not 2.5, but 3 or 3.5, it would help me to pull back and get back up for my next run into the target. So I got into the habit of doing exactly that, putting on perhaps 3, 3.5 turns on the elevator trim. And this was putting an enormous amount of G on the aircraft. And I used to find that I was blacking out at the bottom of every dive. And I went back and asked the instructors and the others if they had difficulty. And quite a lot of them said that they blacked out as well. So anyway, I just accepted this and carried on doing what I was doing.
The feeling, obviously, you explained to me what blacking out was. as it happens at the bottom of the dive, do you come out of that as the aircraft comes out of the dive?
Yes. But, yes, once you got out of the worst of the G forces in the dive, the blood started to come back into your head and you started to see what you were doing and you were compos mentis again. And generally speaking, this would happen when you were pointing in an upward direction. But I had one occasion, I had actually gone into a loop at the bottom of a dive because I had put too much elevator trim on, pulled the stick back. So not only did I go round and start to go back up, I went over the top and came back down again. But I came to in the second dive down, which frightened me a bit. But very shortly after that, I had a very nasty experience because I had, in fact, got an observer in the back with me who was there just to get experience of being in dive bombing situations. And he was sitting in the telegraphist air gunner's seat at the back. And we went into the dive, and I sort of dropped the bomb and then started to pull out again with the elevator trim. And the starboard wing came off. And I just shouted through the Gosport tube that we had, "Bail out." And I pulled my own harness release. And because of the attitude of the aircraft, it was in a very violent spin, I was thrown clear. And I pulled my parachute and it opened just in time to stop me hitting the water. Unfortunately, the observer pulled his parachute a bit early and his parachute caught in the tailplane, so he went in with the aircraft. And that was very sad. Anyway.
What was the reason for the wing coming off? Was it again?
Too much G.
Too much G.
Mm. So there I was in the water in my flying kit. Now, in those times, the flying kit included an overall in quite strong material and fluffy flying boots. I don't know if you ever remember seeing pictures of them. Felt flying boots with fleece on the inside. They were lovely and comfortable and warm, but when you walked in them, they used to slide up and down your heels, and within a day or so, you had holes in your socks. So to avoid getting holes in my socks, I had taken two parachute elastics and put them around the ankles to hold the boots tight on my feet. And that worked well. So there I was in the water with my full suit on and my flying boots. And trying to swim with furry flying boots on is not very easy. So I had inflated my Mae West and got rid of the parachute. And I found that I was really getting a bit low in the water with all the weight of the clothing and in particular these boots. And I couldn't get them off because of the elastic holding to my ankles. So I had to do a little bit of underwater work to finally get these boots off. And then they went away and sank. And I started swimming for the shore. And I noticed almost immediately that the shore was moving past at a fair rate. Because not only was the River Tay flowing out into the North Sea, but it was an outgoing tide as well. So I was moving down the beach faster than you could run, I should think. Anyway, the Wren range assessors had come out of their hut, and they did see me in the water, and they were running down the beach trying to keep up. So I was swimming for the beach, and I suppose I got to the beach about another 3/4 mile down the beach. And I scrambled out, and they grabbed me and took me back. And I was whisked off by ambulance to the sick bay in the air station. And I was there for the rest of that day and overnight. And then they said, "Right, you're okay, back you go to flying." So I went back to flying, and 2 days later I was still doing dive bombing. No cancelling.
I was going to say, how did you feel about obviously getting back into an aircraft so quickly after an accident like that?
Well, I think it goes back to the horse riding situation, just get back in the saddle as soon as you can. And that was what the instructors wanted me to do. And again, you see, I was, 18, young and brash, and really I just accepted what happened. And got back into dive bombing again quite quickly. I don't know if I can find the entry in here, I might be able to. No, I can't seem to find the flight when I fell in the Ogden. Oh, yes, I did. April 26, 1944. Dive bombing crashed. But that was not the fault of the aircraft, I'm quite sure. It's because I was using the elevator trim in a very ham-fisted fashion. So when I went back and made my report as a result of it, there were an awful lot of people thought that I was being a bloody nuisance because they were trying to blame the aircraft for accidents that had occurred previously. And here was I coming up and saying it wasn't the aircraft's fault, it was mine. Anyway, that really passed into the background very quickly.
I was going to say, what degree of investigation would occur? Because you did mention there wasn't much investigation of accidents at that point. But would there be some form of investigation in an accident?
Oh, yes. The captain of the air station or the ship would always have a captain's investigation, and he would make up his mind whether it had to go forward to a court-martial or not. So I was interviewed by the captain and the senior flying officers, and at the end of it, they agreed it was my fault. So I was chastised and sent on my way. But it was amazing how relatively lenient they were about it. I suppose they thought I had learned my lesson. Anyway, I wasn't injured at all. But looking back on it, it must have been a very close thing. So, as I say, East Haven was training for dive bombing and deck landing. So the deck landing school was a situation where an experienced officer would stand on the runway with a couple of bats, as we called them. These were like large table tennis bats, which were very light, but the centre of the bat was fluorescent yellow canvas. And he would stand at the end of the runway to one side and indicate to the aircraft that was landing whether he was going fast or slow, whether he was high or low, or too far to the right or too far to the left. And there were signals which would indicate to the pilot what to do to correct the situation if he was in the wrong position. For example, we were using signals which were orders to the pilot from the deck landing control officer. So that if he had his bat stretched out horizontal, that meant your approach is satisfactory, keep going. But if he thought that you were too low, he would move his bats up, go up. And if he thought you were too high, he'd move his bats down, go down. And if he thought you were to one side or the other, he would just move his one arm up, one arm down, to indicate the change of angle of the main planes that you should be making. And there was another signal for you're going too fast or you're going too slow. And for a wave off, he would just wave his right arm across his chest and you would have to go round again, open the throttle and go round. So the deck landing control officer was there for everyone coming in to land, and you just got into the habit of coming in to land as you would on a deck. Now, the difference between landing on an airfield and landing on a deck is your speed. Because going into a carrier, you go in with a hook underneath the aircraft ready to catch 4 or 5 or 6 arrestor wires that are across the deck and held across at a height of perhaps 4 inches from the deck by hydraulic means. And you would come in, and the intention of the deck landing control officer was that you would land so that your hook was amongst the wires. And the hook would catch a wire, and the wire would pull out and hydraulically slow you down from your flying speed to stop in about 40 yards. So it was quite a sudden deceleration. So the thing was that you had to come in as slowly as you could. And the drawback there was that the slower you fly, the higher your nose is, because you're changing the angle of attack of the main plane in order to get the... still have lift, but you're going slowly. So the nose is high in the air. And in many of the Fleet Air Arm aircraft at that time, with big engines in front of them, we had 12 foot of engine in front of us in the Barracuda, but the Seafire had 14 feet in front of it, and the Corsair had 14 feet in front of it. And you really had to come in a curve so that you were looking over the side of the aircraft instead of trying to look through the solid nose. So you were coming in slowly in a curve. And you came round, and you had to judge this so that you finished your curve over the after end of the ship, levelled off, touchdown. And the batsman was there to help you do that. And with practice, you could do it really quite accurately. It was fine in good weather, and while the ship was going along and everything was hunky-dory, the ship wouldn't be moving at all. But in bad weather, and the ship was going into wind, it would be going up and down over the waves. And, of course, the back end of the ship was going up and down. And in some of the ships, some of the smaller ships, the merchant aircraft carriers and ships like that, the rise and fall in the after end of the ship could be 40 or 50 feet. And 40 or 50 feet means either you catch the wires or you don't. So once again, the batsman is trying to get you into the wires at the time when the ship is moving in a direction which is not going to come up and crash your undercarriage or go down and you miss the wires altogether. So it's a matter of judgment between the pilot and the deck landing control officer, and you're both helping each other to get the aircraft down in the right place at the right time.
Would the deck landing officers be former pilots?
Oh yes, all of them, without any doubt. Usually quite experienced pilots. None of them liked the job much because they preferred to be flying anyway. But they were standing there, and always the ship is into wind, or you're standing at the end of the runway, which is into wind, and these big bats had quite a surface area, and the wind effect on those, when you're holding them out absolutely straight, was quite a strain on the arms. And if you were standing there batting in aircraft for half an hour or even more, it really was extremely tiring. So that was the practice for deck landing. And those on the airfield, excuse me, they were referred to as ADDLs, Airfield Dummy Deck Landings. We were required to make a particular number, I can't remember what it was, before we'd be sent off to a ship. But from East Haven, we were sent off to do our deck landing training on HMS Ravager, which was one of the merchant aircraft carriers.
While you were at East Haven, you practiced on the airfield. Would they mark off a section of the airfield for you to do that?
Yes, they would paint lines to represent the wires. And we had to be landing amongst the wires every time. And once you started flying at East Haven and had done your first couple of sessions of ADDLs, you were expected to land amongst the wires at the right speed, whether the DRCO was there or not. So you just got into the habit of doing it correctly. And it was, as far as I was concerned, a very easy way to land once you got into the habit of doing it properly.
And there's also a difference, I believe, in the way that the Fleet Air Arm practice landings, having to land on carriers, rather than the RAF, or they would land on an airfield as well. do you land in a three-point attitude?
Oh, for the fleet I am, with an aircraft with a tailwheel, you had to land in a three-point attitude, because if you landed on the main wheels, you would almost invariably bounce, and that means that the hook would probably miss the wires. And to avoid you flying into the aircraft that were parked at the front end, there were emergency barriers. Now, the emergency barriers were steel hawsers, which were lifted up on hydraulic arms to a height, the same height as the boss of the propeller. So that if an aircraft missed the arrestor wires and ran into the emergency barriers, the propeller went into these steel hawsers, and the hawsers just closed round the aircraft as it pulled them out. And it was a faster rate of deceleration than the actual arrestor wires, but it prevented you flying into any of the aircraft up forward. But there's no doubt that it damaged the aircraft. I mean, the propeller was certainly broken or bent, and it might well have damaged the fairings and stuff. And in fact, it may have damaged the main planes, if the main planes got caught up in them as well, which would be quite usual. So then there was a delay on deck while that wreckage was lifted out of the emergency barrier, a new emergency barrier fitted, and so it went on. So that if an early aircraft landing on out of a sequence had an emergency barrier, the rest knew that they would be flying around for perhaps quarter of an hour, maybe 20 minutes. So if they were getting short of fuel, it would be causing a little few beads of sweat. But anyway, we'll come back to that aspect again later. The dummy deck landings were quite different from the RAF, who fly in to land at an airspeed possibly 10 knots or 15 knots faster than we did. And they would float further down the runway anyway and get a very gentle landing on their main wheels mainly. But if they had a tailwheel aircraft, some of them would try and get the tailwheel down, but generally speaking, they were content to land on the main wheels and run until the tail dropped. Latterly, of course, in the fleet here, when we got jets, we had tricycle undercarriages, but you still got to the attitude where the tail was well down when you were coming into land, because you were flying as slowly as you comfortably could. Anyway, we did, I think it was four deck landings each in Ravager, and that was the end of that training.
Was Ravager underway while you did it?
Oh yes. Because the ship had to have wind speed over the deck. You probably want to get the maximum speed that the ship could give you. The big ships, like the big fleet carriers, they give you 30 knots over the deck, whether there was wind around or not. But generally speaking, it was convenient to have 30 knots over the deck. So the ships would steam at a speed, so that the ship speed plus the wind speed would give you 30 knots. And in strong wind conditions, people have been known to fly off and land on in harbour, but definitely dependent on the wind speed. So that was four deck landings, and we were then in a position to go and join whatever squadrons we had to join.